Good morning and welcome to Spotlight 92. I'm your host, Malvin Massey. And of course, every Thursday we talk to the movers and shakers of the community of the world, people who are doing things for your benefit and mine. Our guest today is an author, biographer by profession, and also now a historian by choice. His new release, the book was just released on the 9th of this month, July the 9th. It's called Some of My Best Friends Are Black, The Strange Story of Integration in America. And the author is Mr. Tanner Colby. He's our guest this morning. Good morning, Mr. Colby.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for giving us a call. Like I said, this book is so relevant to our situation right now. But you are not an old guy.
No, I feel old. I'm 37, but I'm not old in the grand scheme.
Yeah. So what made you what put your focus on making this book?
Well, it was a bit of an inspiration that came about by Obama's election, really, which got a lot of people talking and thinking about this in ways that we hadn't before. And I realized that here I was voting for our first black president, and I didn't know any black people. Yeah. Not in any meaningful way. I didn't have any close black friends. I'd never been to a black person's house. No black person had ever been to my house. And I thought, well, that's a pretty interesting, or might be, could be an interesting way to go back and look at what went wrong in the wake of, in the wake of the civil rights movement, when we were supposed to integrate, we were supposed to have all these programs like school busing and affirmative action that were going to make things more equal and make things more fair and open. And, my life's not that special. I'm just a normal middle-class guy. My parents were their first in their family to go to college. We weren't rich. We were well off, but we weren't rich. And so, my world, I don't live in a world of exclusive country clubs and wealthy million-dollar homes. So clearly there should have been more racial interaction at this socioeconomic level than there was. And the fact that there hadn't been, meant I could use my life to go back and be a window to look at what mistakes were made. As you referenced earlier, the situation with the schools there in Memphis is exactly what's going on in Birmingham, and everything is coming home to roost of the mistakes that we made.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the first chat, that it just struck me as so odd as I was reading the book. And the story of what was happening in Birmingham, man, your research is so cool. You went all the way back to the beginnings of things. But it's the same thing. The outlying suburbs right now in Memphis, Tennessee, are planning to get their own school, create their own school districts, pay for their own schools. And all the rhetoric is about the education of the children and so on and so forth. But
right.
And I think what on the side, it's racism.
Yeah, it's racism, and I think that's what the wisdom of the principal in Vestavia Hills now. He grew up in Vestavia Hills, which is of course the rich white flight suburb that I profile in the book. And he left, and he went and was principal at some struggling urban schools at Tarrant and some other places in Birmingham. And then he came and brought that knowledge back to Vestavia. And what he realized and what he understand is that, you can't balkanize all these school districts and expect to have a successful ecosystem, because what happens in one school district impacts the school district next door. And so, the suburbs need Birmingham to have a viable school system. And the suburbs of Memphis, they can break off and form their own bureaucratic whatever if they take their tax base and abandon the downtown schools. Then people are going to find a way to get to where there are good schools. Yeah. And then you're going to get students who kind of come out of struggling school system coming into your suburban school system, and it's going to strain your resources, and you think you've escaped the problem, but all you've done is run away from it.
And the real way to deal with it is
to turn and face the issue together, black and white, city and suburb, rich and poor, and to figure out how we educate our kids.
That is the very story of Vestavia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, exactly the same story. My God, it's really amazing. The rhetoric has changed so much over the years, but the situations are still the same.
Mm-hmm.
Integration has been lost because of, I don't know, though. Do you look at things like you think there's a certain amount of integration that's lost because people like to congregate among people like themselves?
I think that's part of it. I mean, part of it is we've put these huge institutional barriers, like expensive housing and separate school districts, and part of it is institutional barriers. Part of it is a cultural preference that is perfectly natural and harmless and understandable, and part of it is a fear and aversion. I don't know, I'm not comfortable with that over there, so I'm just not going to go over there and find out about it. And I think that's a natural human tendency to cluster with, you know, what you're familiar with. And the problem in America with that is that one group has all the money because we stole it over the last 400 years. And so when Black America tends to congregate with itself for a sense of social comfort and solidarity and you know, holding on to those cultural traditions, it's a perfectly understandable desire to have, but the access to money and power and opportunity is on the other side of the street, so to speak. So how do we bring our cultures together so that we feel comfortable together socially so that everyone can share in terms of access to opportunity?
But I wonder if the media is not the biggest culprit in keeping things separated as they are. Some of the things that we see on television and the movies and what have you, and then some of the news broadcast, and my God, some of these some of the rhetoric of these campaigns. It's like going back to the Civil War almost, only with metaphors. Nothing said out front. It would be much better if it was just like it was back in the days of secession, but.
It's definitely we with the political rhetoric and, you know, a lot of the entertainment that's put out there, it focuses on extremes. The very antagonistic, the Tea Party, everything they say about Obama, everything is race and racist, and so we've polarized the dialogue in how we illustrate it. And I try to sort of do the opposite, whereas I was less interested in this faction all the way over here of racist white people who just won't have anything to do with Black people. You know, to me, that's, you know, they're a problem and they're, you know, a very serious issue. But those people aren't going to be a part of the solution. So they don't interest me at the end of the day.
Okay.
You know, it's very, okay, we acknowledge you, you're racist, and, you know, that's fine. But to me, what I find interesting and what I wrote about more in the book is the well-intentioned people, Black and white, who were just on either side of the color line, who could probably coexist and share much more than they do, and yet we don't. And one of the things that surprised me the most when I was writing was about this integrated neighborhood in Kansas City called 4963, which is named between 49th Street and 63rd Street. That's where it gets its name.
Okay.
And that was a decades-long process of white homeowners and Black homeowners trying to form a stable, integrated community so that they could then produce an integrated school where, you know, all the kids could feel it was their school. And so for 10 years, they worked very hard to, you know, to have no mortgage discrimination, to protect everyone's property rights, not to have any of these predatory lending scams that take advantage of Black homeowners and poor homeowners. And so they really made a conscientious effort to build a mixed-race community. And even that barely worked.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so it's one thing for us to look at these antagonistic forces of Black versus white, Republican versus Democrat, and how we're all at each other's throats. And that exaggerates the sense that makes us feel more antagonistic than maybe we should be. But it's a more interesting story and speaks much more to the complexity of what we're dealing with when you look at, okay, here's a group of people, Black and white, that tried to do the right thing, and it still didn't quite gel. Mm-hmm. It was still almost impossible to get it right. That, to me, is the strange story of integration. That's a much more interesting piece of the story, and one that needs to be told, because, you know, I think, you know, you get this polarized rhetoric where conservatives are going on TV and, you know, calling Black people all, you know, food stamp president and all that nonsense. And then you get on the other side of the aisle, you just get this reflexive, you know, blame of, you know, rich white people for all the problems. And so we stay at each other's throats more than we need to be when we could be talking about, okay, where's this place of consensus in the middle where things should be working better, but they're not? Because that's where we're going to find the solution, is there in the middle. And it's like King said about Birmingham, after Birmingham, the problem in Birmingham wasn't the bad people who did bad things. The problem in Birmingham was the good people who did nothing.
Very prophetic. If you just tuned in, by the way, this is Spotlight 92. We're talking to author Tanner Colby. His new book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black, The Strange Story of Integration in America, is just released on the 9th of July. And the stories in this book are very reflective of our lives right now, particularly in our area, but all over the United States. And it was something that I would ask you, you know, the book is divided into different categories: suburbs, education, advertising, and churches. And, well, it's amazing to me how the churches are still some of the most segregated institutions in America. But what made you, why did you divide into those categories, the suburbs, education, advertising, and the churches?
Well, there were two primary considerations going in. One is that I wanted to avoid, I didn't want to do things like the military. You know, integration has been very important in the military, but most people aren't in the military. So I picked schools, neighborhoods, workplace, and church, because those are four really institutions that we all go to. Everyone has a, you know, everyone can, the things in the book are unique. Vestavia Hills is unique, but like you say, you can relate it to your experience in Memphis. And so I felt like those four things would be institutions where everyone could relate to that. And I also wanted to break it up geographically. Alabama's the Deep South. Louisiana's kind of just Louisiana, its own thing. And then the real estate section is out in the Midwest. And then, you know, the advertising chapter takes place in New York. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I wanted it to be geographically. If it were just all in Alabama, people would say, well, that's Alabama. So I wanted to break it up geographically. But the main thing I realized in hindsight of the advantage of how I wrote the book, but I didn't know going in, was that when we talk about race, especially when, you know, lawyers and academics and these people like and government people study the problem, they tend to study it in silos. People look at, you know, you can read a whole book about school segregation, it'll have one chapter on housing discrimination. Mm-hmm. Well, housing discrimination is at the root of segregated schools. And you can't fix, you know, we spent a decade or two decades, you know, shuffling all these kids around the map on all these school buses, but we didn't do anything to fix, to give the government any power to fix housing discrimination. Because, believe it or not, white conservatives and white Democrats didn't want blacks moving into the suburbs. So housing discrimination, we didn't touch that. So if you were going to just shuffle kids around the map without fixing the root problem of where people can live and where people can afford to live, then we didn't really fix the problem. We were just hacking away at the branches instead of dealing with the root. And same thing with a lot of workplace discrimination. People talk about workplace discrimination in terms of the law and what the law is going to do and what affirmative action and all these programs are going to do. And what I found in looking at advertising is that advertising, you know, it's a relationship business. It's a social industry that's based on not so much your credentials and your education, but your ability to schmooze and sell yourself and get to know people and form these relationships, and that's how you move ahead. Well, if black people and white people aren't socializing with each other in places like church, that has a direct impact on who works where and who gets what jobs. And so you can't really talk about workplace discrimination strictly in the matter of what goes on in the courtroom, but you have to talk about what we're doing in our social lives. Because personally, you know, working in things like advertising and publishing, and, you know, I don't know how it is in the radio, but every opportunity I've had has come from somebody I know. You know, somebody says, hey, you should, you know, they're opening this new magazine. You should call them about being a writer. And then you call them and you're first in line for the new writing gig. And if you don't know the person who knows that the new thing is starting, then you're not in line. And so the fact that I grew up and come from where I do means that I have lots of those social opportunities. Yeah. And if you're a working class black person who doesn't get to go to the right schools, doesn't get, you know, enough financial aid or scholarships, or, you know, can't get, you know, mixed income housing in a wealthier neighborhood with better schools, then you just never get access to those doors of opportunity. Mm-hmm. So unless we start knitting the fabric of society back together, which is why this whole idea of the suburbs of Memphis breaking off and forming their own system is such a terrible idea, the more we try and balkanize ourselves from each other, the more we're hurting our own opportunities. Because right now, white people have all the jobs and all the money, and so it's fine for us that we can just live in our own world and have tons of opportunity, but the world is getting more diverse. And if white people continue cordoning themselves off from the rest of the growing minority population, then eventually that's not going to work either.
That's not good. Yeah, eventually that's going to backfire.
Yeah, well, it's already backfiring on the Republican Party now if you look at their voter base. Yeah. But so, you know, we have to find a way to form a common community.
You know, it frightens me, though. You mentioned about Tea Party. We know that a lot of that is rhetoric that they have going on, but a lot of their rhetoric sounds so disturbing to me. Mm. Because it reminds me, I'm a history buff, and it reminds me of so many different situations over the years of a small group of people influencing a larger group of people with radical
right.
ideas that they are making up, that they're creating
yep.
a situation that's not there. Pop culture, on the other hand, is there are a lot of black people and black communities that are, how would I say, it's so introverted, so into such a hopeless mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And the culture shows it off. All those guys, the hip hop culture, especially those guys with their pants hanging off of them and their hat sideways, and they you know, making it a big deal to be a convict or a thug or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That part of the black community is unconcerned with what the situations are that they're having to live with the things that are going on around them. Do you think that proper integration could probably change this frame of mind from them as well? I mean, I know they've got as much to do with this segregation. I know a lot of places and a lot of people that I don't want at my house, and I'm black. And I can think of a lot of black people I wouldn't want at my house, or a lot of situations
right.
I wouldn't want to get
right.
into.
No, there's definitely, there was a huge, huge part of the black community that after, you know, one great quote from the church chapter that has stuck with me and I really sort of had in mind when I was framing the rest of the book is when the blacks, you know, chose not to integrate with the white church. And I asked the leader of the opposition, you know, why he didn't want to do that. And he said, you know, all the blacks wanted was a little respect and we didn't get it. So we didn't stay.
Mm.
And, you know, people will put up, the human animal will put up with a lot of things, you know, in terms of, you know, lack of food or wealth or anything else, but people can't live without self-esteem. People can't live without respect and or the feeling that they're being respected by the people around them. So people will naturally retreat to a space where they feel respected, which is how you get this sort of oppositional culture where black people stay to their own. They're completely inward-looking because they are completely hopeless with the idea that they'll get respected
yeah.
in majority white America. And so it's like, screw them, we're not even going to deal with it. And it's an understandable reaction that people feel that way, but it's just, it's too hopeless. Because black people and white people do get along in this country every day, despite what you see about the Tea Party on the news. And, you know, if you just look at the math of it, you know, even if half the white people in America feel the way the Tea Party does, that still means that, you know, 35% of the country or half of white Americans are okay, decent people.
Yeah.
And, you know, black people are only 12% of the population. So there's enough white people out there to find hope with and to make relationships with if you find them.
Yeah.
And you don't listen to the rhetoric and presume that all of America is like the Tea Party.
Now, that is another thing, too, the presumptions that are caused mm-hmm. by the media and pop culture. And I
right.
guess we need to all try to fight those things off. As
yeah.
best we can by meeting people and talking to people and reading
and
books
that's,
like
that's,
yours.
And that's the main thing that I've done. You know, there's no The thing about racial integration is that it is very, very hard, but it's also very, very simple. In the sense that, you know, for me to go as the only white person and walk into, you know, go to an HBCU campus and just to walk up and talk to people, which I did, you know, it's not an easy thing to do because you do feel uncomfortable in situations where you're the odd man out and you don't know anyone, you don't know the culture and the customs. But, you know, all I did in the last 4 years, starting from a point of pretty much total ignorance, all I've done is read books and talk to people. Mm. You know, that's really sort of the secret formula, is read, you know, educate yourself and engage with other human beings and learn about them as individuals and as people, and to stop thinking about black folks versus white folks. It's about Tanner Colby. It's about Malvin Massey, you know. Mm. And so it's very, very difficult and you know, to go out and make those connections, especially if you're not, you know, like a type A outgoing person who's naturally like that. So it's hard to do, but it's the recipe itself is very simple. Read books and talk to people.
Simple enough. If you just tuned in, by the way, once again, this is Spotlight 92. We are talking to author Tanner Colby. His new book is Some of My Best Friends Are Black, The Strange Story of Integration in America. It just went on sale on July the 9th. It's out there right now. It's online. Where can people pick it up, Tanner?
People can pick it up. My website is www.tannercolby.com, and from there there's links to, I mean, you can just walk into any bookstore and get it. Or it's online at Amazon or online Barnes & Noble. Should be available anywhere.
Out everywhere, yeah. Because it's so relevant for right now. You did an awful lot of, I was so impressed by your going, like I said, you're not an old ancient person. So I was very impressed by the research that you did. Did you learn much? Did your history education pick up any from the research you did?
Oh yes, I was. In fact, I mean, that's the really sad thing about what we teach about race in this America. I went to Tulane University in New Orleans. I have a 4-year private college degree with an American history major, and I didn't know most of this stuff. So that tells you about, you know, what's being taught. So I had to go and learn, you know, pretty much all of it myself. But, you know, I joked in the beginning that, you know, my ignorance was the only qualification I needed to write this book. And I think that was true because, you know, I knew that I didn't know anything. And I knew that I was going to have to do a ton of research going in. And I was also petrified because, you know, the last thing you want to be in this country is the white person who screws up something about race and says something wrong and then gets embroiled in some big controversy. So I was, you know, paranoid that, you know, I'm going to miss something. I'm going to mess something up. I'm going to get something wrong. And, you know, Al Sharpton's going to, like, call me out on it and say, oh, but didn't you get this big obvious thing that every black person knows and you didn't even look it up? And so I was like, so I over-researched everything to the nth degree. And I also, you know, realized that most white people who write about race, they do it from the safety of a partisan point of view. Yeah. Whether it's a white liberal talking about, you know, how Barack Obama's the best president ever and, you know, the Tea Party's all racist, or it's a white conservative who's on his side saying that, you know, oh, you know, black people can't take care of their kids and they're all dependent on welfare and, you know, they don't like me because I'm telling the truth and I'm just going to tell it and it doesn't matter if they don't like me. I mean, it's a safe way to be a jerk, you know, to sort of hide behind that standard conservative dogma about race. But I didn't do either of those things because I didn't have either of those preconceptions. And I sort of came to everything with as open a mind as possible because, like I said, I knew that I was stupid.
It's so it's so obvious, though, that to grow up in this country and to live in this country that such a thing as this would overlap into your own personal life. And you refer to your own personal life quite a bit in here as well.
I do. And that was sort of the thing that was interesting. Most interesting to me is to think that, you know, we think of this in terms of being, quote, black history.
Yeah, the civil rights movement and all of that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's everyone's history, and you know the ways in which, you know, my father's an architect, and so we went wherever there was construction, and all the construction in mid-century America was driven by race and white flight suburbs, and where racial covenants said, you know, that white people were building suburban homes, and so, you know, and also ad agencies I worked in, and you know, so the narrative. I set out to write a book about why I didn't know any black people, and the whole story of my life was black people start to finish. I mean, the only reason my high school existed was because they were trying to do this end run around a desegregation lawsuit.
Yeah.
The only reason we moved to Birmingham is because of the way that the suburban migration was creating more construction for white people outside of downtown, and you know, and abandoning downtown.
Yeah.
So, you know, the whole story of my life being a white guy from the South was, of course, shaped by race. It can't not be. And so, you know, if we think about things that way, it's important for all of us to see that, you know, we're all interconnected.
I mean, that's something that struck me too, reading this book. What you just said, that there's a basic foundation and reason for everything that happens, and we've been nitpicked around in through this and that. We've said, well, this is why this happens, this is why that happens, but the basic foundation has been race since the end of the Civil War, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to me. And while we're talking about this new rhetoric as the time is going getting down, we're talking about the new rhetoric of things going on and the idea of people saying things that they don't mean to say. Like recently, Mitt Romney mentioned up in Kentucky at a little sit down that he was going to win the election. When they asked him why was he winning the election, basically he just said, "Well, because I'm the white guy," and of course he backed off of it real quick. But
did he really say that? I missed that.
Yeah, it was at a little cafe in Kentucky, and somebody was there asking what made you think what is going to be the reason that you win, and he said, well, a lot of people don't appreciate, a lot of people don't like what Barack Obama is doing, but on the other hand, I'm the white guy in the race, so I'll probably win. You know, it was like that. It caught me off guard, but at the same time, I thought, okay, well, he's just being honest about what I thought in the first place. I didn't even think that Barack Obama could win the election when he did win it.
Right.
And do you think this is going to be, is this election going to be a forecast of integration? Is this going to tell if people have changed any or not? Because the last time, I think a lot of conservatives were not thinking that Barack Obama was going to win anyway.
Yeah, I think last time everyone was, you know, sort of taken by surprise. You know, it happened so suddenly. It was, you know, within about 9 months that all of a sudden, can this guy be president? Oh, wait, he is president. Wait a minute.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think now, like before in 2000 or in 2008, you know, they hadn't developed the right code words necessarily to bring race back into it, and now they sort of have with the, you know, Newt Gingrich and his food stamp president and all that.
Yeah.
And so they're definitely, it's going to be more racially polarized. I don't want to predict what's going to happen to it. I think race kind of stayed out of it last time just because, you know, other than the dust up over Jeremiah Wright, real people didn't really know how to bring race into it or what to say, because it all happened so quickly. And I think now you're going to get a lot more of the coded attacks about socialism and, you know, healthcare being reparations for black people and all this stuff, which aren't even really code words, really. It's pretty blatant and out in the open.
Sort of obvious.
So my hope is that Obama will win. I think he will, just because Romney's just so bad.
And there's another racism involved in that, just like Kennedy, the situation with Kennedy and Catholics being Catholic. And
right.
Romney,
I mean,
a lot of people are not really into that.
Yeah. So, I mean, who knows how it's going to play out. But I think, you know, Obama's election, it's definitely brought a lot of the racism to the surface. But I don't think that is either good or bad, because we all knew the racism was there. It's a question of what we do with it. Can it be a cathartic moment that we use to get better, or will we retreat and fall back? Don't know.
Very interesting, though. The book is Some of My Best Friends Are Black, The Strange Story of Integration in America. The author, Mr. Tanner Colby himself, our guest on Spotlight 92. Tanner, thank you so much for giving us a call, man. And I hope the book does quite well, which I'm sure
it will. Thank you very much. It was great speaking with you.
All right. And this has been Spotlight 92. We'll do it again next week. In the meantime, you're back for more of the best in jazz. This is U92 FM.